Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a profile of the latest candidate running for President of the United States, Evan McMullen, and speak with Priscilla Alvarez, assistant editor at The Atlantic, where she has an article, Never Trump's Last Ditch Effort, and discuss who is behind this apparently quixotic run by a 40-year-old Mormon bachelor who used to be with the CIA before becoming the chief policy director for the House Republican Conference. With 50 former senior Republican national security officials in an open letter warning Trump, quote, would be the most reckless president in American history, and Republican Senator Susan Collins saying Donald Trump does not reflect historical Republican values, and a former presidential speechwriter for George W. Bush urging Trump's running mate Mike Pence to ease Trump off the ticket, we will look into the piling on against Trump happening in Republican circles. Meanwhile, Trump himself suggested today that gun rights activists he calls the Second Amendment people might be able to stop Hillary Clinton, hinting that he means, presumably, with a bullet. Then we'll examine the nationwide strike in Pakistan by lawyers after a heinous suicide bombing at a hospital in Quetta, where 74 people were killed as they gathered to mourn the assassination of the head of the Balochistan Bar Association. Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan who was a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies Program and the author of Fighting to the End, the Pakistan Army's Way of War, joins us to discuss the hyping of the Islamic State's involvement in this attack in Pakistan and an earlier one in Bangladesh by so-called terrorism experts. Then finally, we will look into today's meeting in St. Petersburg between Russian President Putin and Turkey's increasingly autocratic leader Erdogan, and speak with Dimitar Beshev, a visiting scholar at Harvard University's Center on European Studies, who is an expert on the politics and history of Turkey and Russian foreign policy. He joins us to discuss his article at Al Jazeera, What's Behind the Turkey-Russia Reset, and the irony that as U.S.-Turkish relations continue to deteriorate, ties between Russia and a NATO ally are likely to grow stronger. And joining us now is Priscilla Alvarez, who is an assistant editor at The Atlantic, where she has an article, Never Trump's Last Ditch Effort. Welcome to Background Briefing, Priscilla Alvarez.
Thanks for having me.
And the last ditch effort that you're referring to, of course, is the Never Trump movement appear to have recruited a candidate. Evan McMullen is their man. So what do we know about this? What is he, a 40-year-old Mormon bachelor, formerly with the CIA and with the House Republican Conference? So a blank sheet there. So I'm asking you to fill us in a little bit, Priscilla.
Absolutely. And you sort of mentioned a lot of his resume there. He's a former CIA staffer. He's worked for Goldman Sachs, and he had recently been the policy director for the House Republican Conference. And yesterday he announced that he will be launching an independent presidential bid. So he is largely unknown. He had about 135 Twitter followers before this announcement, so he was really under the radar. But it's not totally surprising. We also had the Never Trump movement consider the National Review's David French to launch an independent presidential bid. So mostly this is shows an attempt by this movement to upend Donald Trump's campaign months away from the general election and sort of provide that conservative alternative in some states through their man now, Evan McMullen.
Well, I must say that the tweet, since that seems to be the new currency of political discourse now, that he apparently tweeted during the Republican National Convention saying authoritarians like Donald Trump use promises of law and order to justify infringing on civil rights as they consolidate control by force. So is he basically, do you think he's motivated by a kind of a concern, which apparently is being expressed by 50 Republican foreign policy experts who wrote a letter critical of Donald Trump saying he would be the most reckless president in American history? So do you see it in that context?
Well, I think we've seen a big movement of, well, former CIA staffers, former CIA directors, national security experts that have moved to support Hillary Clinton, or in this case, simply to denounce Donald Trump's rhetoric and some of his policies. And here we've also seen Evan McMullen express his discontent with Donald Trump's Muslim ban. So he is someone that has expressed frustrations with Donald Trump, and this is sort of the next step for him to show that discontent. But yeah, this is generally what we're seeing at this moment among Republicans, or at least experts that have worked for Republican presidents, that are starting to get some distance from Donald Trump.
So in your article at The Atlantic, Priscilla Alvarez, Never Trump's Last Ditch Effort, you mentioned that the group behind him is Better for America, and they appear to be facilitating McMullen's run, but they'll have to sue to get him on the ballot. My understanding is that he's already missed ballot deadlines on, what, something like 23 states?
Yes, he has missed deadline for about 26 states, actually. Yes. Mm-hmm. And in order to get on those ballots, they would have to sue. But one of the states that he would probably do best in and could really challenge Donald Trump is in Utah. And their ballot deadline, if I'm not mistaken, is on August 15th. So there is some time for him to get on that ballot, and there's confidence that he will be able to. He's Mormon. He went to Brigham Young University. Utah, actually, in the primaries, coalesced behind Ted Cruz. So that is really the state that we could see some sort of challenge from McMullen against Trump.
So, but it's not, of course, a swing state, although I think it's got about, I think, six electoral college votes. But I take it the significance of Trump losing Utah is that Trump has to win all of the states that Romney won, plus the Rust Belt states. And this, of course, Utah is a state that Romney certainly won.
Yeah, exactly. And Romney actually came out during the primaries to also show discontent with Trump and sort of rally behind Ted Cruz. And again, I want to note that Evan McMullen, it's not necessarily that he'll win. It's a long shot candidacy, but it's mostly the meaning behind it and sort of showing that this anti-Trump movement is still alive and there is an attempt to disrupt, undermine the Republican Party's nominee.
So how much then does, and by the way, when you say that Mitt Romney expressed his displeasure with Donald Trump, it was I think, pretty tough words, wasn't it? He called him a fraud and all kinds of rather blunt language was used from this normally mild-mannered individual. So how much are Romney's fingerprints over this group of people that are pushing this candidacy of Evan McMullen?
I can't say with certainty what sort of influence Mitt Romney plays in all of this. I haven't seen any reports to say that or to suggest that he is involved. But under the umbrella of Republicans that are unhappy with Donald Trump, he is certainly one of them. And there is sort of a wave of that happening right now, the latest being Senator Susan Collins, who said that she would not vote for Donald Trump either.
But aren't some of the people who raised funds for Mitt Romney involved in the Never Trump movement?
Yes. So in that respect, we do the group that is facilitating this candidacy for McMullen is partly funded by John Kingston, and he is a Boston conservative donor who bundled for Mitt Romney. So in that sense, yes, you're correct. There are some indications of Mitt Romney, but him specifically and what he's doing to facilitate this candidacy is pretty unclear right now.
And there's also the prominent Republican operative Rick Wilson. He supposedly is going to help run McMullen's campaign. Does Rick Wilson have any ties to Mitt Romney?
Yes, he does. But And I keep going back to this. I think this is something that we're just going to keep seeing, is that there are people that are connected with previous presidential nominees and Republican presidents. But largely, I mean, Romney did express his discontent, but with presidents too, or former presidents, they are either staying mum or they've already express that. So where they're going to come into these independent presidential bids will sort of remain to be seen moving into November.
Well, there's no question that Susan Collins' op-ed in Tuesday's Washington Post is pretty damning. I mean, some of what she said was, I think, even more damning because of it coming from her heart, it seemed, that she was genuinely found him, I'm trying to think of a word milder than repulsive, but she certainly found him to be unsuited to be the standard bearer of the Republican Party.
Yes, that's true. And in that sense, Donald Trump has struggled to gain votes and support among women. So that could make a dent in that effort as he tries to coalesce women voters moving into November. So that could certainly make a dent there. She also expressed displeasure with Hillary Clinton, and I believe the latest is that she had an interview with CNN in which she raised the possibility of writing in a candidate. So this is certainly, at least as Donald Trump moves to grasp some voters moving into November that he hasn't done well with and hasn't gained a good reputation with, this could hurt him among women voters.
And just to rub salt in the wound, because it does seem to be coming from all quarters, the dissatisfaction with Trump, and we're talking about specifically among Republicans, there's an op-ed in Tuesday's New York Times by a former George W. Bush speechwriter basically calling upon the vice presidential nominee, Pence, to essentially take over the ticket and ease Trump out the door. Have you ever seen anything like this? This has got to be one of the strangest election years ever.
Well, this election is certainly completely unpredictable. I hesitate to predict anything moving forward. For that reason, there has been a lot of ups and downs and a lot of twists and turns. And Mike Pence is certainly interesting on the Republican ticket, because we have seen him sort of play a different role, a calmer role next to his nominee. So that's certainly been an interesting dynamic. But we also saw ups and downs, twists and turns with the Democratic primary with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. So altogether, it's been quite unpredictable. And so we're going to see the culmination of that now in the general election as Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton go head to head.
But given these ballot deadlines, don't they cast a tremendous complication over these scenarios? Notwithstanding that Evan McMullen himself is going to have to deal with this as a latecomer, it seems that as you get further and further towards November, the options diminish for alternatives to Donald Trump, and then they get quite complicated and quite bizarre. And then, of course, then if you go all the way to the Electoral College after the election, then it becomes even more Byzantine. So it seems like if anything's going to happen in this regard, it has to happen pretty soon.
Well, yes, for Evan McMullen. But we also have other candidates that are running. We have Libertarian Gary Johnson, and he is hoping to get on the debate stage with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump as another candidate alternative. So prepping to the presidential debates starting in September, that'll be interesting to see if the discontent among voters with the two major party candidates will translate into something more for candidates like Gary Johnson and Jill Stein. And then as far as Evan McMullen, again, his best bet to disrupt the Trump campaign to an extent would be in Utah, and there doesn't appear to be any trouble with him getting on that ballot. It would only require, I believe, 1,000 or so signatures, which, you know, being from around there, shouldn't be too difficult for him to garner. But again, this is a long shot candidacy, and it's more why it matters and the meaning behind it versus having him be shot up to win in November.
And of course, if Gary Johnson is having a hard time getting to the 15% threshold to qualify to appear on the stage in the debates, Evan McMullen is even a greater long shot in that regard.
Yeah. Yes, yes, that is absolutely true.
So when I first heard about, when I first read your article, Priscilla Alvarez, about Evan McMullen, I called a bunch of CIA people, retired, of course, that I know, and nobody had heard of him. But then I called Bob Baer, who's the national security analyst for CNN, and he knew him and said he'd been in touch with him when he was a senior staffer on the House Foreign Affairs Committee working with Congressman Ed Royce on Iraq. And Bob Baer told me that Evan McMullen was an extremely knowledgeable expert on Iraq, on the tribes in Anbar, and all of the complications in terms of coming up with some strategy to combat the Islamic State. And Bob Baer told me this guy's a very impressive guy. He really knows his stuff. So I was wondering, because everybody said, well, you know, the CIA people said, well, I don't know, it doesn't make sense to have a Mormon in operations because, you know, you couldn't recruit a foreign spy and meet him in a bar if you can't have a drink. But apparently that is not the case with this character. He apparently is quite competent, at least according to Bob Baer. What have you heard in that regard about his background in the CIA?
Well, I've heard that he has, he has an impressive resume, not only with his stint in the CIA, but also with his time as an investment banker with Goldman Sachs, and then also later at the House Republican Conference. So I think that's true. I don't know him, so I can't speak to as much to that. But I think more so with an impressive resume or not, it's also he's largely unknown. He's not someone that is, if we could establish someone's popularity through Twitter, he's just not very well known. And so this is what makes it a long shot candidacy, among other things. And I'm sure that that's something that we'll continue to hear about, is his qualifications. But it's also interesting, right, that the anti-Trump movement has also picked up conservatives who have no experience in elective office. We saw the same thing with David French. So we'll sort of see how this plays out in the next few weeks and months.
But presumably by now, Evan McMullen has more than 135 Twitter followers.
That is true.
How's he doing?
I think the last I checked, we were above 1,000.
Oh, I see. So to wrap this up then, Priscilla McMullen, this feels like part of this broader questions about national security that are being leveled against Donald Trump as a responsible and capable steward of national security, with this letter from 50 former senior Republican national security experts, many of whom served in the Bush administration, some under Dick Cheney, and of course the former head of the NSA and the CIA, Michael Hayden, among them, Michael Chertoff, Tom Ridge, Dov Sackheim, John Negroponte, and Eric Edelman, who I mentioned as served under Vice President Dick Cheney as his top national security advisor, Robert Zoellick as well. So do you see that as Trump's Achilles heel here? Because they're certainly piling on.
Sure. I think it's hard to establish anything as a definitive Achilles heel for Trump. We've seen a lot happen so far in this election. But what I do think is interesting is also how the Hillary Clinton camp has sort of embraced this this mantle of national security as the defense and military candidate. We've seen this at the Democratic National Convention, and we're now seeing it in campaign ads. So I think that'll be interesting, too, as it unfolds, is seeing how the Clinton camp embraces this moving forward.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Priscilla Alvarez.
Well, thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Priscilla Alvarez, who's an assistant editor at The Atlantic, where she has an article, Never Trump's Last Ditch Effort. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the hyping of claims that the Islamic State was involved in the heinous bombing in Pakistan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Christine Fair, who's a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies program, who specializes in South Asian security issues. She's a member of Women in International Security and the American Institute of Pakistan Studies. And her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And across Pakistan today, on Tuesday, there's a nationwide strike by lawyers who are protesting as 74 people are buried, most of them lawyers, from a bombing that took place in the southwest city of Quetta. And it was quite a heinous crime, in as much as 60 of those that were killed in Monday's bombing at this government hospital were lawyers who'd gathered to mourn the assassination earlier that day of the president of the Balochistan Bar Association, Bilal Anwar Qasi. So why are, and of course, both the Islamic State and the Pakistan Taliban have taken credit for this murderous act, but just setting aside who was responsible?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question, and a lot of people are talking about this. I don't think that the militants, per se, really have a good understanding of what lawyers do in Pakistan. And the reason why I say this is in 2007, there was this thing called the Lawyers Movement that was widely believed to have been pro-democracy and instrumental in bringing down President Musharraf. In point of fact, that really wasn't what happened at all. And the lawyers, some of those very same lawyers that were upheld as beacons of defenders of democracy, were in fact involved in defending the killer of Salman Taseer, who was the governor of the Punjab, who stood up against blasphemy. So, you know, in the absence of any better argument, I suspect what's happening is that they really don't understand that Pakistan's lawyers are not this bastion of liberalism that the rumor has claimed, at least since 2007.
Well, all we've heard from the Islamic State is one of their, in Pakistan, is one of their associates, I guess, for the want of a better description, said that the Quetta carnage had been planned for 2 months and that they had targeted lawyers, quote, who support democracy and make laws.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that's exactly what I said, right? That they don't really understand this lawyer movement and what they've actually done. So what I actually hadn't seen that piece, but it pretty much aligns with my explanation, which is there's this perception that Pakistan's lawyers are promoters of democracy. Now, let's be clear. Some of them are. So Asma Jahangir is an unrelenting fighter for democracy. But the vast majority of lawyers in Pakistan don't do any such thing. And, of course, they don't make laws. And so, interestingly enough, the statement of ISIS is exactly what I had offered is the only plausible explanation.
Well, I guess we can't attribute too much political sophistication to them. I mean, they're not necessarily a bunch of Einsteins, right?
Well, so this is the other issue about ISIS in Pakistan that gets, I think, a lot of confusion in the press. One, these these guys are not necessarily taking orders from al-Baghdadi in Syria. The guys that are operating under the flag of ISIS are actually their original militant activity is that they were anti-Shia militia members operating under the names of Lashkar-e-Jhangvi or Sipeh Sabeh Pakistan. When the Pakistani Taliban formed, because the Pakistani Taliban, like these anti-Shia militias, like the Afghan Taliban and a number of other militant groups, they share an ideology. They're Deobandis. They share an archipelago of Deobandi mosques and madrasas, and they have Deobandi political leadership. When the Pakistani Taliban began to form, some of these anti-Shia militia commanders joined the TPP. Then these have been the very same commanders that have been reflagging themselves as ISIS. And the reason for that is that these anti-Shia sectarian murder outfits have much more in common with the TTP, much more in common with ISIS than they do any other group in the region, including the Afghan Taliban, which for all of its crimes, you couldn't really say that the Afghan Taliban were terribly sectarian, with the one exception of what happened in 1998 in Mazar-e-Sharif.
So there's some doubt as to whether the Islamic State are, you know, responsible, because both them and Pakistan Taliban are taking credit for this.
But remember what I said, though. Remember what I said. This is where people get really hung up.
Right.
These commanders can basically, you can be both.
Right.
In this, in the post-Mullah Omar Taliban, what we're seeing is that members, commanders of the Pakistani Taliban are rebranding themselves ISIS.
Right.
Right. So basically, they're just putting on a different T-shirt. Now, when Mullah Omar was alive, it was very difficult to do this because of legitimacy that Mullah Omar had. But after his demise, the discipline of the Pakistan Taliban and its fealty towards, you know, the Afghan Taliban leadership and al-Qaeda, it simply has not been retained. So it's not a coincidence that both of these organizations would be taking credit, because the commanders are actually the same. It would be as if, you know, sometimes you moonlight for GE and sometimes you moonlight for John Deere. And so that's essentially what's happening with these groups. And so it is very difficult to discern. And basically what it comes down to is to what the commanders of the attack say when they conducted the attack. And sometimes we actually do get commanders who were responsible saying that I did this on behalf of the Islamic State or I did this on behalf of the Pakistan Taliban. But at the level of organizational branding, both organizations have some legitimacy in taking credit for the attack. So what we really want to hear is from the commander that conducted the attack. The other thing I really want to put some water on, because it's driving me nuts every time I hear someone say this in the commentary about this attack, you'll hear a lot of people who somehow have learned this idea of target substitution. I was listening to NPR, the Geo Analyst, which is a Pakistani news organization. Even Michael Kugelman wrote this in the Wall Street Journal blog. They're saying that this is a new tactic because they can't go after hard targets, they're going after soft targets. I want to remind everyone that terrorism in Pakistan was always about soft targets. In fact, that's what terrorism is about. It was, in fact, an aberration that the Pakistani Taliban were able to go after so-called hard targets, including Pakistani military, paramilitary, police forces, and intelligence agencies. In fact, there's nothing new in this targeting. This is what terrorists have always done in Pakistan. It is the aberration that they went after hard targets. This is, in fact, what history has generally shown us, is that terrorist groups go after hospitals. Hospital bombings and school bombings have been a longstanding staple of terrorism in Pakistan. I have data going back to the 80s, and I'm sure if we had data that went back before the 80s, we would see the same trend. There's absolutely nothing new in this. This is standard operating procedure for Pakistani terrorist groups.
So given what you've told us about the possibility that these commanders are, as you say, wearing just changing T-shirts, and there's some doubt as to whether al-Baghdadi is ordering this, Then what do you make of the Islamic State taking credit for the attack in the restaurant in Dhaka in Bangladesh, which killed 22 people? And back in July, they claimed responsibility for a suicide bombing in Kabul, in Afghanistan, which was aimed at the Shiite minority. And a lot of people were killed in that.
Yeah, okay. So let's take Bangladesh first. I know all of the terrorism analysts who don't know a damn thing about South Asia, who didn't know Dhaka was indistinguishable from a city in Africa before this attack, hopped on the ISIS bandwagon. It's simply not true. We're seeing a similar thing in Bangladesh. The traditional Bangladeshi militant group that has very long-standing roots is called the JMJB. The five fellows, the so-called ISIS attackers, and if you go back and you look at the photos of these so-called ISIS operatives, they're holding the same gun. And it's the same gun for all of these five dudes. And you know it's the same gun because the gun is all scratched up. It's also not an AK-47. It's actually a training rifle. It's a knockoff of a Romanian training rifle for the AK-47. And you can see it's the same gun that all five of these fellows have because it's a scratched up gun. You can see it's unmistakably the same gun. At the Holy Bakery attack, the majority of people were actually killed with knives. And there were two pistols that were recovered. This is not ISIS. The fellows, to get more publicity for their attack, affiliated that attack with ISIS. Now, the distinction is important for the following reasons. There is no evidence that these fellows had any kind of training whatsoever. These were very unsophisticated attackers. They were very crudely armed. And because the Bangladeshi authorities were basically bullied by the international, you know, terrorism analyst cabal, they delayed going into that bakery by many, many hours because they were cowed into believing that these were ISIS operatives. They're on record saying that if we had known that these were JMJB, we would have gone in earlier. So the readiness to label these things as ISIS attacks has consequences. And in this case, people died because of this. So I'm very adamant in not hopping to the judgment and calling things ISIS when they aren't. Now, let's turn to Afghanistan. ISIS is real in Afghanistan. And interestingly enough, just as I was telling you a few minutes ago, most of the ISIS fighters that we're seeing in Afghanistan are actually Pakistani. General Nicholson, who is the leader of NATO forces in Kabul right now, he recently made some statements that as many as 70% of the so-called ISIS fighters in Afghanistan are actually Pakistani. So we have two kinds of people in Afghanistan calling themselves ISIS. One are these LEJ commanders who went to the TTP, which is the Pakistani Taliban, and then they defected to ISIS in Afghanistan. The other kind of ISIS that we're seeing in Afghanistan are actually disaffected Taliban commanders from the Afghan Taliban who have been disillusioned for a number of reasons. One is that ISI, Pakistan's External Intelligence Agency, has made a strong effort to control the Afghan Taliban for its own purposes, not for the Taliban's purposes. Some militia commanders are calling themselves ISIS so they can engage in criminality with impunity and without retribution. So we have a mix of individuals in Afghanistan operating under the name of ISIS. These tend to be much more competent terrorists than we see in Bangladesh. You know, I think one of the reasons why Bangladesh doesn't draw the attention that other places have is that we haven't seen suicide bombings. And Bangladeshi terrorists are actually pretty incompetent, which speaks to the fact that had they been more competent fighters in the Holy Bakery attack, the fatalities would have been much higher. And again, had the Bangladeshi security forces not been misled into thinking they were ISIS operatives, lives could have been saved. So that's sort of like the skivvy of ISIS across Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. There's also some important emergence of ISIS fighters coming from India as well. And as we've seen elsewhere, the ISIS fighters coming from India, they actually tend to be very well-educated, and they're coming from the southern states of India, not from the north, which we tend to associate more with the Kashmir conflict. So these are coming from Muslim communities that are actually fairly well developed in terms of human development indicators. Many of them are professionals. And these are the fellows from India and their wives that are going to fight for ISIS in Syria.
So, Chris Fair, just returning to the nationwide demonstrations in Pakistan today by lawyers who've gone on strike in solidarity against their brethren who were slaughtered in Quetta. The demonstration outside of the Supreme Court in the capital, Islamabad, the Supreme Court Bar President Ali Zafar called for the government to do more to protect lawyers. This is a government, in spite of the fact that there's the old joke that Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. Why can't the Pakistan army protect its own citizens, particularly, you know, professionals like lawyers?
So, look, it's very difficult. Even in the United States, right, if we actually had terrorists that were hell-bent upon attacking our hospitals, there's very little that we would be able to do to prevent this. And I think this is, unfortunately, a vulnerability that all countries have. So the fact that Pakistan has so many militants that want to kill Pakistanis is an artifact of the very simple fact that Pakistan has grown militants to use as tools of foreign policy in Afghanistan, in India, and even within Pakistan itself. So what Pakistanis are experiencing is really good old-fashioned blowback. So that's the first thing, is that Pakistan has, you know, as Secretary Hillary Clinton said years ago when she was in Pakistan, Pakistan's military and intelligence agencies have been growing snakes, hoping that snakes only bite their neighbors. Well, snakes don't work that way. So that's the first thing, is that they've, you know, they have literally trained tens of thousands of Islamist militants, and they have not been able to keep all of those militants on the leash. And many of them, as we've seen, for a variety of reasons, have turned against the state and against Pakistanis themselves. So part of it is the problem in Pakistan is just so enormous. The second thing is that Pakistan doesn't really have the will to deal with this problem. For some years, it's been waging a selective military operation against militants in the federally administered tribal areas known as FATA. This operation is known as Zarb-e-Azab. I call it Zarb-e-Nonsense because it really is an operation of nonsense. They undertook this operation very selectively. They want to root out those militants that have turned against the state, but they want to leave in place those militants that still kill at the behest of the Pakistanis. And their belief is that if they can turn a militant and persuade that militant to go kill Indians or go kill Afghans or Americans and our allies in Afghanistan, then that's a rehabilitated militant. And they've been running, as they've been doing these military operations, so-called rehabilitation programs for bad militants. Until Pakistan has decided that it's not a good policy to use terrorism as tools of foreign policy, Pakistan can't defeat this. Pakistan cannot say to Pakistanis, these kinds of jihadis are good jihadis because they don't kill you or target the state and help the state's interests, but these kinds of jihadis are bad jihadis, and in fact, they're not jihadis at all, right? It's very difficult to sustain public appetite for supporting some kinds of non-state actors like the Afghan Taliban, Lashkar-e-Taiba and its various namesakes, but why the Pakistani Taliban is a bad organization. If you were a Pakistani, how would you make sense of this bifurcated policy? It's not obvious that anyone would be able to make sense of this bifurcated policy.
Well, just in closing then, and I take it that the Haqqani network is another example of this.
Of a good mood, good terrorist.
The good
they
terrorist.
Love the Haqqani network.
Right. So we've often speculated about this dysfunctional relationship that the U.S. has with Pakistan and the extent of this serial duplicity. And are there any indications in the world you are in Washington that the U.S. is just to some extent going to cut bait?
So there are some positive signs in that direction. So the first sign was that when Congress basically said you can buy F-16s on your own dime, we're not subsidizing it, the White House did not do what the White House usually does, which is go into high gear to put pressure on Congress to make those concessions, as opposed to putting pressure on Pakistan to stop supporting terrorism. We've also seen a willingness to continue the so-called Coalition Support Funds program, which is the process by which we paid Pakistan to ostensibly help us success in our war efforts in Afghanistan, even though they were killing our people in Afghanistan, has been renamed. It has its own dispensation now. But the willingness to have parts of those funds retained, in other words, they can't be expended unless there is a certification that Pakistan is doing all that it can against the Haqqani network, that is still retained. And you also see no interest coming from the administration to perjure itself, saying that Pakistan is in compliance so that $300 million can be released. One of the hypotheses that I have is that when Peter Lavoie, who is a senior NSC member on Obama's staff, floated the idea of a nuclear deal for Pakistan, a so-called way to normalize Pakistan as a nuclear power, providing that Pakistan made certain concessions with respect to deployments, with respect to pursuit of tactical nuclear weapons, which Pakistan has been vigorously pursuing now for a number of years. Pakistan basically told the U.S. government under no uncertain terms, go bugger off. And I think that was very chastising because it had the effect of making the administration officials realize that there's nothing that we can do that's going to make Pakistan give up using terrorism under its nuclear umbrella. And I think that actually sobered any of the enthusiasts who thought that they could somehow be general whisperers. So I am seeing increased appetite to hold Pakistan accountable. There have even been local election campaigns being run against incumbents, against candidates that supported giving F-16s to Pakistan, whether or not they bought it with their money or ours. So you also see across America an increasing, you know, whiskey tango foxtrot moment. Why are we continuing to give these guys money, even though they're killing our troops in Afghanistan through their Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani network? And, you know, when you meet troops who have come back from Afghanistan, you ask them who the enemy is. They don't mince words. They will tell you it's Pakistan. So this message is getting out, and politicians are going to have to hear it and take heed of it, or they're going to lose some of their races. And obviously, much is going to depend upon what happens in the Senate and the House with this upcoming election. But if all things were to look as they are now, I see an increased willingness to stand up to Pakistan and hold them accountable for their crimes.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Christine Fair.
Thank you so much.
And again, Amy, speaking with Christine Fair, who's the former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan and a professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies program who specializes in South Asian security issues. She's a member of Women in International Security and the American Institute of Pakistan Studies. And her latest book is Fighting to the End, The Pakistan Army's Way of War. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into today's meeting in St. Petersburg between Russian President Putin and Turkey's increasingly autocratic leader Erdogan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dimitar Beshev, who's a visiting scholar of international relations at Harvard University's Center for European Studies and a professor at the University of Sofia, where he teaches European studies and international relations. He has written extensively on the politics and history of modern Turkey and the Balkans and the EU external affairs and Russian foreign policy. And he has an article at Al Jazeera, What's Behind the Turkey-Russia Reset. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dimitar Beshev.
Thank you.
And on Tuesday, Turkish President Erdogan and Vladimir Putin met in St. Petersburg, Vladimir Putin's hometown. And it looks like they're making up after the shoot down of the Russian jet on the Syrian-Turkish border. And there's a sense that Putin's call to express his support for Erdogan right after the failed coup had an effect in opening up this otherwise strained relationship. So isn't it a bit odd, though, from the American perspective, Dimitar, to have a member of NATO cozying up to President Putin?
Yes, it is. But it's not that we haven't been in this world before. Turkey's relations with NATO and with the U.S. have been strained on multiple occasions in the past. What's also remarkable is how quick it took to Turkey to normalize relations with Russia. When the incident happened in November, my hunch was that they'll de-escalate and they'll find a way out of the crisis. But no one expected it to just take 6 months. And it also goes to show that the Russian policy tends to be very pragmatic and opportunistic. They find ways to benefit from current events and to advance their goals. I mean, Brexit was such a moment, but Turkey's trouble with the coup and the economic hardship it faced as a result of Russia's sanctions have given Russia a strong hand as well. So Putin has been playing well what he has at his disposal.
Well, they have a mutual interest, of course, in the Turkish Stream pipeline project of Gazprom. But you're suggesting also in your article that Putin may be trying to win over Turkey to help him extricating himself from Syria, where he doesn't want to get bogged down in mission creep.
Absolutely, yes. Russia has faced the difficulties of being involved in such a complex situation where you don't have an easy way out. After the announcement in March that the mission was over, we've seen actually escalation and Russia saw some losses. And the prospect of getting bogged down in Syria is all too real now. Russia needs a quick deal with the West over Syria where it secures its influence. And obviously Turkey should be a part of the deal as well. But having said that, it's very difficult to foresee the fine print of such a deal, given all the moving parts in the Syria story. What will happen today in the follow-up meeting on Syria, the two leaders will no doubt express their will to narrow the differences. But it won't be that easy. Just as a sidebar, the offensive against Aleppo failed, partly because Turkey was able to scale up its support for the rebels. Despite the heavy Russian airstrikes, the Syrian regime forces couldn't make any headway, which also goes to show that for all the convergence of interests, there are also lots of conflicts and tensions between the two, which are difficult to measure, to manage.
Well, there's no question that Erdogan himself is suffering from blowback from, you know, restarting the war with the Kurds in order to consolidate more executive power and helping Daesh, the Islamic State, with a kind of underground railroad, and not to mention enormous amounts of military supplies, as you just mentioned. And he suffered blowback from bombing attacks. But I guess there's some confluence of interest with the Russians, given that the June bomb attacks at Istanbul Atatürk Airport were attributed to jihadists from Russia and other former Soviet republics. So what do you think's going on in St. Petersburg? Because these are both authoritarian leaders, but Putin is a very rational and calculating guy, whereas Erdogan seems to be a bit of a megalomaniac with paranoid tendencies.
I think with both of them, you have a mixture of reason, calculation, opportunism, if you will, and with ideological vision. We tended to assume Putin was very flexible until the annexation of Crimea. and his campaign in 2013 to sever the links with the West or to build force with Russia. Then equally, Erdogan is seen as a somebody coming from the mold of political Islam with ideological agenda. But over the years, he's shown flexibility as well. He started as a pro-democracy leader, embraced the European Union, only to lean back to authoritarian habits. And now what happens in Turkey is Erdogan is softening to part of the opposition, certainly to the parliamentary opposition, trying to co-opt them, reaching out to all those individuals or actors victimized by the Gulen network, which is a sign of pragmatism on his side as well. Those two leaders can do deals. Respect one another, no doubt, even if they don't love each other and they have second thoughts about the ulterior motives. It's the same old story about Russian-Turkish relations. Lots of people attempted to attribute everything to the strong leaders. But the mixture of cooperation and competition is more long-standing. It dates back to the early 90s, really, when Turkey tried to push into the post-Soviet space, was encountered resistance from Russia, but later on they patched up differences, could find models vivendi, could cooperate on economic affairs, but equally continue competing on other issues in all those regions from the Caucasus to Central Asia. So, yeah, I mean, it's not just Putin Erdogan, it's a more long-term pattern of bilateral relations driven by interests and structural conditions.
But I guess the most glaring comparison here, Dimitar, is that while Russia and Turkey are making up and forming a kind of rapprochement, the US and Turkey are going in the opposite directions. And here you have, again, a member of NATO and an important NATO base down in the south of Turkey, at Incirlik, that the US is using in its war against Daesh, the Islamic State. There's no question that Erdogan has whipped up his people into a frenzy of anti-Americanism, blaming the U.S. for this failed coup because they're harboring Fethullah Gulen, who Erdogan blames for everything. So, and he's purged the military, he's purged the academia, he's purged the judiciary as a result. So as long as Erdogan is playing the anti-American card, he's doing that essentially to force the Americans into giving up Gulen, which probably won't happen. So do you foresee a continuing deterioration of relations between the U.S. and Turkey?
Yes, the relations are entering a very rough patch. But it's important to underscore once more that it's not unprecedented. Turkey has always been a difficult partner from the early 60s onwards, really. Cyprus.
Sorry to interrupt you. Can we repeat that? There's a little bit of interference there. So,
The relations have never been easy, starting from the early 60s. The Cyprus issue, global wedge, the war in Iraq was an irritant for some time. Remember when Turkey sided with Russia during the war in Georgia in 2008, building some distance to the Americans. And if there's some institutional memory in D.C., it's how you deal with a difficult partner that Turkey is, but indispensable nonetheless. And Erdogan will play to the gallery. Anti-Americanism is really deep-seated in Turkey, and it transcends political divisions. You're as likely to see it on the right-wing religious side as on the anti-American left-wing as well, but he can easily fall back into a more cooperative stance, given the change of circumstances. I don't think Turkey is to sever relations with NATO, because it needs NATO as the ultimate security guarantee.
Well, but there's more trouble brewing, I think, in terms of rubbing salt in the wound on the already frayed relationship between the US and Turkey, because there's a big case going on down in the courts in Florida where an Iranian businessman has been on trial for money laundering, and supposedly he was laundering money for Erdogan's sons. And as we know, the split between Gulen and Erdogan happened because of Gulen going public with corruption within the mm-hmm. ruling family of Erdogan and his sons. So do you think that a lot of this is bluster because Erdogan's, you know, worried about, although he pretty much controls the press now, I don't know whether the Turkish people are going to find out about this corruption.
Well, they'll find out, and obviously the knowledge has been in the open. Reza Saraf, the Iranian businessman, was subject of extensive investigations by various journalists in Turkey. So this story is well known about the gold and sanctions busting. But the point about Erdogan is that he has a bedrock of support, a 40% plus of Turkish citizens, which is a strong plurality of votes. And for all its flaws, the Turkish political system is still based on fairly free elections. Of course, the government has an edge. Of course, it controls the media. But there's no rival, AKP, there's no rival to Erdogan at this point. So I think the electorate in Turkey or sufficient number of Turkish voters will swallow whatever corruption scandal and will forgive Erdogan all those flaws at the end of the day, so he can feel secure at home despite all those problems. But yeah, I mean, all those corruption deals, investigations, there's another one in Italy against Erdogan's son Bilal, by the way, will add to the rising tensions between Western partners and Turkey. But I think Turkey will be pragmatic. There will be anti-Western campaigns in the media, but when it push comes to shove, Erdogan knows that Turkey remains dependent for its security on the Western partnership, but even more so on the economy. For all the talk of Turkey being a rising economic power in the Middle East and elsewhere, it continues to trade overwhelmingly with the EU. And the EU is the source of 80% of foreign direct investments going into Turkey. And this really matters because if there's an economic crisis, that could be the real game changer for the Turkish political scene. And these are all limits to the otherwise unlimited power that Erdogan builds in domestic affairs, especially after the coup.
Well, Dimitar Beshev, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dimitar Beshev, who's a visiting scholar of international relations at Harvard University's Center for European Studies and a professor at the University of Sofia, where he teaches European Studies and International Relations. He's written extensively on the politics and history of modern Turkey and the Balkans, EU external affairs, and Russian foreign policy. And he has an article at Al Jazeera, What's Behind the Turkey-Russia Reset? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Whoa.